Welcome to the Astrophys Podcasts.
My name is Brendan O'Brien, and first of all, we would like to acknowledge Australia's first astronomers, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, the traditional owners and custodians of the land we are on. This episode is produced on Yorta Yorta and Kaurna country. And we'd also like you to influence your local politicians to do more to mitigate climate change by moving from fossil fuels to renewable energy sources. We're now in our ninth year of production with over 180 fabulous interviews with top scientists from all over the world. Each month, we produce two fabulous episodes. On the first of each month, Dr. Ian Astroblog Musgrave gives us his monthly sky guide, plus a unique astrophotography challenge. Then, on the 15th of each month, we publish an interview with a leading astronomer, astrophysicist, space scientist, data scientist, telescope engineer, project manager, or particle physicist, and we discover their science journey and rare insights into how they think and conduct their amazing research into exactly how our universe works. Our audio files and transcripts are available on our website at astrophys.com, and MP3s can be freely streamed from SoundCloud,
Google Podcasts,
and Apple Podcasts.
But right now we're zooming over to Adelaide in South Australia to speak with Ian.
Hello, Ian.
Hello, Brendan.
Great to be speaking with you again, Ian. And can you tell us, mate, what's up in the sky for April?
Well, it's always wonderful to speak to you, Brendan. And in the month of April has a number of interesting things happening. Now, sadly, most of the bright planets have vanished from our evening sky, and Jupiter is scraping the horizon over the next few weeks.
Yep.
But despite that, a number of interesting things are happening. To start off with, daylight saving is going to end on April the 7th. So once again, the Australians will be united in the same time zones in Central Australia and Eastern Australia, which also makes telling you about when things are happening a lot easier.
Yep.
As always, I'm going to start with the moon. So April the 2nd is the last quarter moon. April the 9th is the new moon. April the 16th is the first quarter moon. And April the 24th is the full moon.
Yep.
The moon is at perigee on April the 8th and at apogee on April the 20th. So Easter is coming up. And over the Easter period, we're going to have reasonably dark skies so you can go out and look at the pretties. And then over the next couple of weeks, you'll have plenty of dark sky time. So let's go back to the evening sky. I've already told you that Jupiter is lowering in the northwest evening sky. It's getting progressively lower and progressively difficult to see as the month progresses. And possibly by the end of the month, you won't be able to see it very well at all. On the 10th and 11th, Jupiter is bracketed by the thin crescent moon, low in the twilight. And you probably will need a low-level horizon to see it at its best. Jupiter and Uranus are within binocular distance of each other. Yeah, they're coming closer over the month, but they'll be very difficult to see in the twilight when they're at the closest on the 21st. In fact, they're probably only visible in civil twilight, where the background light will make it almost impossible to see Uranus even in binoculars. So that's the evening planetary action. Now let's look to the morning sky, where a lot more interesting things are happening.
Yep, yep.
Having said that, I'll say there's one more interesting thing coming up in the evening sky, but I'll talk about that later on. So Mercury returns to the morning sky from about mid-month, and at the end of the month, it'll be quite visible. On the 19th, Mercury is 2 degrees. That's about two finger widths from Venus, but the pair are still deep in the twilight at this time, and you'll probably need binoculars and a level unobscured horizon to see Mercury. However, by the end of the month, Mercury's prominent at nautical twilight and is making a nice line with Mars and Saturn. Now, obviously, as I've just said, Venus is sinking further into the morning twilight, and by the end of the month, it'll be virtually unobservable. So it's transiting from nautical twilight to civil twilight. It's sufficiently bright that you can still see it reasonably well at civil twilight, but at least at the beginning of the week, as nautical twilight is transiting into civil twilight, the view of the lineup of Mars, Saturn, and Venus will look very nice indeed.
Yep.
So on the 8th, Venus will be above the crescent moon. Again, this is quite low in the twilight, but it will look very nice in binoculars.
Yep.
And again, as I said, on the 19th, Mercury is 2 degrees from Venus, but you'll need binoculars to really see Mercury. Now, Mars is still climbing higher in the twilight. And on the 6th, the crescent moon is above Mars. So you'll have a line of Moon, Mars, Saturn, and Venus right down low at the horizon.
Nice.
And then Mars and Saturn are coming closer together. So Mars is going to be close to Saturn on the 11th. And that's because Saturn is also climbing higher in the twilight. So on the 7th, remember on the 6th, the crescent moon was just above Mars. On the 7th, the crescent moon is just below Saturn. So the lineup of Mars, Saturn, crescent moon, they're with Venus down low on the horizon. And again, that's going to be quite attractive. As I said, Saturn's going to be close to Mars on the 11th, when the pair will be less than half a finger width apart. And they're going to be easily visible together in not only binoculars, but in the medium power telescope eyepiece. So you should be able to see the rings of Saturn as well as the Mars being a tiny disk.
Ooh.
Yeah, so that will be very nice. That will be also an astrophotography challenge. Oh, the main challenge there is simply getting up at that hour of the morning rather than any technical photography challenge. So those are the main planetary action. Now, remember I said that there's another thing happening in the evening?
Yep.
This is the Comet 12P. Now, Comet 12P, Pons Brooks, is a Halley-style comet, and it's currently entertaining Northern Hemispherians. We've seen some really nice photographs of the comet near the Andromeda Nebula. So it will come into the evening sky around about mid-month, and it's going to be reasonably bright. Now, when an astronomer says bright, it means brighter than magnitude about 13. And yeah, typically many of the bright comets are things that you can only see with a humongous telescope. But it'll be coming in at around about magnitude 4.5 and will actually get brighter as it rises. But unfortunately, it's going to be very low to the horizon initially. And so even though its real magnitude is 4.5, you're looking through all this horizon murk, and it will be more like magnitude 5. So really probably just visible to the unaided eye if you've got a good eyesight, more likely going to need binoculars.
Yep.
So on the 14th, it's going to be quite close to Jupiter. In fact, it'll be within binocular distance of Jupiter, to the south of Jupiter. So if you get your binoculars out, look at Jupiter and look about a binocular diameter to the south, you should be able to see the comet. Now, the comet's going to be, even though it's relatively bright, that's magnitude 5 is, of course, above unaided eye visibility. Because it's an extended object and a fuzzy object, it will be a lot harder to see than something of the same magnitude that it's a star, for example.
Yep.
It continues to rise higher in the sky. So by the 21st, it's now substantially above the horizon. There's less murk. It is actually brighter. It's a magnitude 4.4. Wow. But it's close to two of the brightest stars in Taurus, Chi and Omicron Tauri. They're relatively visible as relatively bright stars, very close together. They're just now down from the head of Taurus the Bull, so yep, should be able to check it out quite easily. So it's on the opposite side of the horns of the bull. It's forming the body of the bull. So V shape of the head of Taurus the Bull. You follow that down by a couple of binocular distances, and you should see the pair of the stars that represent Chi and Omicron. And on the 21st, the comet will be within binocular distance of them. So focus your binoculars on that, and the comet should be visible there in binoculars. You might be able to see it with the unaided eye. Again, it's going to be higher in the murk, and you'll have less atmospheric distortion, but it's still, because it's a faint, fuzzy object, you may not be able to see it very well with the unaided eye. during the rest of the month, it gets higher and higher still, but now, but now it's starting to fade. Unfortunately, most of the, there's no good signpost stars, but if you've got your binoculars trained on the pair of Omicron and Chi, Tau, and sweep up towards Orion, you should be able to pick it up as it goes. And also, if you managed to detect it when it was next to Chi, Tau, you should be able to keep on watching it night after night as it goes up. And as the sky gets darker, it'll be easier to see, even though it's fading.
Okay.
And for those of us who are in the Northern Hemisphere, waves to Northern Hemisphere people, if you're in the United States, you'll be able to see the total eclipse of the sun on the 8th. That is, if you've already booked accommodation a year in advance and booked your plane tickets a year in advance. If you live close to the line, which goes through Texas, Atlanta, Kentucky, Indiana, Pennsylvania, and New York, up into Maine and Ohio, then you might be able to drive to the center line and watch the eclipse, but don't count on getting any accommodation because all the eclipse fanatics will have booked it out. But it's going to be a very good eclipse. It's going to be a nice deep eclipse. So be able to see it for over 3 minutes. The best observation is in southern US, North Mexico, but everywhere else we'll still see a nice duration eclipse. And because the moon is not far from perigee, where it's closest to the Earth, it's nice and big. So you've got a nice big shadow and you should be able to get some very good images of the corona if you can get there. So that will be excellent for our North American listeners. If you've got a chance and you're living close, have a go. If you're not living close, then it's too late. You should have organized yourself much better, which is what I always say. Because every year I say, oh, I should go and visit this eclipse in somewhere interesting, and I never do. So there's one last thing to look at. If you've been watching the sky, you'll be noticing that the Southern Cross has been getting higher and higher. The last episodes, I talked about the Southern Pleiades and the nice little cluster just heading off the Southern Cross. If you train your binoculars on the Southern Cross itself, just below Beta Crucis, you'll see a nice little sprinkle of stars. This is the jewel box, and this is one of the lovely sights of the southern skies. It's called the jewel box because there's a lot of different colored stars. It's small, but it is absolutely beautiful.
Yes.
And that's it for the sky. There was lots happening, lots to do, but unfortunately lots of it involves getting up very early in the morning.
Excellent. What a good thing to do. Okay. Keep going, Ian.
Okay. Would you like a tangent?
I'd love a tangent. The tangents are a highlight for me.
Okay. Well, next time you're looking up at the International Space Station or Tiangong as it goes over, and this month around about the middle of April, there should be some nice ISS passes around about mid-month. Spare a thought for us passengers and wave to them. Now, I'm not talking about the human passengers, but the not human ones. So the ISS has played host to a range of organisms, ants, fish, mice, tardigrades, and bobtail squid. But all of those have been intentional experiments. So they've taken the organisms up into the space station to see what microgravity does to them.
Yep.
Or how they respond to microgravity. But I'm talking about the unintentional passengers, much smaller and with greater horror movie potential. I'm talking fungi and also microorganisms, but mostly fungi. Now, to set the scene, back in 98, we first learned that fungi could survive in outer space in a rather dramatic way. So the cosmonauts on the Russian space station near saw a strange film spinning across the outside of a window. Yes, that's the outside. And this thing kept on growing, destroying the window's titanium quartz surface and getting into the space station. Are you freaked out yet? This is where we turn on the spooky music. Now, it turned out these space invaders were not space invaders, but homegrown fungi that had hitched a ride on the spacecraft and had learned to survive in this vacuum of space. And I tried following up on this particular fungi, but getting the peer-reviewed papers has proved difficult. So I can't tell you they've actually identified them, but I can't tell you what they are. But anyway, as a result of this, we take a lot of care to keep stuff going into space sterile. So the payloads move through clean rooms, they've got high-powered air filtration systems, they're thoroughly mopped and scrubbed with disinfectants. So the things we take into space are generally at least reasonably sterile. But you can't do this to humans. Fungi grow on human skin, as other microbes, and get into space with us. So even with the best cleaning procedure, there's still fungi lurking on the space station. So again, this has horror movie potential, but there's been a long-running experiment monitoring the microbiomes of the International Space Station. And so far has found that the ISS microbiome in the ISS is broadly similar to the urban Earth environments. They fluctuate a bit from month to month, but they're not horribly dissimilar to the Earth environments. That's the microorganisms, fungi and bacteria that are living inside the space station. There are some differences. There's some rarer yeasts tend to be more abundant and colonize the astronauts, but so far it doesn't seem like anything's going to be really toxic. But like Mia, there are microbes living on the outside of the ISS.
Yep.
And the researchers have found that microorganisms not only survive in these environments, well, we knew that from the ISS, but retain their reproductive ability. And most of the microorganisms exhibited increased biochemical activity and resistance to antibiotics, which is not such a good thing. So in order to study the response of microorganisms to living in the vacuum of space and the radiation of space, the European Space Agency has started the lichens and fungi experiment, testing how fungi behave in space and in Mars-like conditions. Cool. Unfortunately, the abbreviation LIFE is the same as the title of a Netflix horror movie about an out-of-control life form that startlingly looks like an overgrown fungus and takes over the International Space Station with horrifying results. So the ESA exposed a lichen to the exterior of the International Space Station for 18 months. That is over a year. And it survived. There's no water, no air, extreme temperature, constant bombardment, radiation, and the lichen didn't even go into stasis, but it kept right on photosynthesizing.
Yeah, cool.
This might seem bizarre, but lichens are really radiation resistant. They can survive something like 12,000 times the dose that would kill a human.
Cool.
Not only that, there's a fungus called Cryptococcus neoformans that actually eats radiation in roughly the same way that plants eat light, we think, because we still don't quite understand how it works.
Yep.
And they were discovered inside the reactor at Chernobyl. And part of the reason why they're able to survive and or eat, inverted commas, radiation is they produce a huge amount of melanin. So NASA sent these melanized fungi to space in 2016, and then did a long-term experiment from between 2017 to 2018, looking at whether or not these fungi could not only survive in space, but could they protect the ISS from radiation. And they found that the fungi indeed could cut radiation levels on the ISS by about 2%. This was done with relatively small patches of fungi, and they worked out that they had a more comprehensive fungal sheath, this could cut it down by around about 4%. That doesn't sound like much, but it still is another layer of security reducing radiation hazards on the ISS. And it could be incorporated with other materials. You could grow a thicker fungal mat. You don't have to worry so much about locking all these materials into space in one go, where the fungi can just nicely grow for you. And it might be also useful on Mars, where you could use these fungi to grow inside the Martian structures to help shield the Martian structure from radiation. So one day these microbes might help shield spacecraft and habitats from some radiation. So even though the fungi in space has the potential to be a type of horror movie topic, it turns out these things may in fact be greatly beneficial and help us as we move to be a spacefaring society.
Fantastic, Ian. It reminds me how prescient NASA and JPL were to crash Cassini into Saturn rather than let it wander around space and potentially deposit its hitchhikers into a moon or somewhere else. And makes me wonder what hitchhikers are on board Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, which sooner or later, possibly later, will eventually reach other star systems. And it begs the question what hitchhikers are doing on the surface of those spacecraft.
Well, both the Voyagers and the Pioneers before them were extensively sterilized before they went into space. So hopefully, if anything survived the sterilization process, the extended period in deep space will have sterilized anything. On the other hand, when Beresheet crashed into the moon, it was carrying a load of tardigrades. And tardigrades are notorious for surviving high radiation and dehydrated conditions. So they're hoping that the radiation on the moon will have killed any of the tardigrades that survived the crash, if any did. But the space fungus story might suggest that they might be a little bit more resilient, and maybe the next moon colonists will find tardigrades on the moon.
Fantastic. Okay, Ian, do you have an astrophotography challenge for us for the month of April?
Yes, I do. And guess what? It revolves around Comet 12P. Now, because everyone's had a go at stacking images from their simple cameras or phones, and you're now familiar with stacking software, it's time to move out and use it for something different. Now, Comet 12P is a different challenge to Vesta. Vesta was quite dim and basically on the limit of what you would be able to image with simple point-and-shoot systems. But Comet 12P is much brighter. But on the other hand, it's an extended object. So a star-like object of the same magnitude is easier to image than an extended object because the brightness is more fuzzed out.
Yep.
And also because the comet is roughly at nautical twilight rather than deep astronomical twilight, you've got more background light. So with Vesta, you can go all out, do very long exposures and stack lots of long exposures at the highest possible ASA ISO rating. With 12P, you've got the issue that the background twilight, if you try too much exposure, the background twilight will overwhelm Comet 12P. So I would suggest that rather than doing quite long exposures at ISO 3200, which is what I was using, try something lower like 1600. Try not to run the exposures for longer than about 4 seconds, maybe 1 to 2 seconds, depending on your camera and its response, and do a good stack. So I found for my Canon Ixus, a stack of 30 images was good for bringing up Vesta. Possibly you can get away with fewer, but stacks of maybe 10 to 20 images might be helpful. And again, play around a bit. Because you've got some really obvious guide stars, unlike with Vesta where you had to fritz around a bit trying to find exactly where the guide stars were and making sure you got in between the guide stars, on the 14th for Jupiter and on the 21st for the pair of Chi and Omega Tauri, they're easy to see guide stars and fairly easy to focus on. So have a bit of a play around, try some different exposure times and different exposure ISOs, in order to get a feel for what's happening. Stack away and see if you can pull the comet out against the twilight. Now, the images I've been seeing from the northern hemisphere have been showing some nice, nice tails, but again, they've been taken under very dark sky conditions where they've been able to stack lots of relatively longish exposures to bring out the tail. So it'll be a bit of a challenge to, in nautical twilight, that is an hour after sunset, to try and pull out the tail against the background sky. But it's well worth it. It's going to be a nice little comet. And hopefully everyone can get to see it, not only in binoculars, maybe possibly with the unaided eye if you've got good eyesight. And hopefully with your cameras, you can pick up something very nice.
Fantastic. I'll look forward to that, Ian.
I've got a very good view from where I am because I've got ocean as my western horizon. So I don't have to worry so much about trees and things getting in the way. It gives me quite a bit of an advantage, but the marine layer tends to get quite high. So it gets the extinction of the comet and stars is quite significant, even though you've got a good distance above the horizon. So I'll get to play around and I'll look forward to seeing the comet. And now having said that, it's probably going to be weeks and weeks of cloud where I'll see nothing whatsoever.
Well, I'll be trying that. I've got a mirrorless camera that I can attach to a 6-inch telescope, and I've also got a 400mm lens I can attach to a DSLR. So I'll be having a good shot at that. So wish me luck. Yeah.
I wish you luck. I wish you clear skies and low horizons. And having said that, the entire southeast of Australia will now be socked in for the next month.
Of course. Well, thank you very much, Ian Astroblog Musgrave. A fabulous preview of what's up in the sky for April. A great tangent and an inspiring astrophotography challenge. I'll be giving it my best shot.
Fantastic. And let's hope some more people are enthused. And are people able to submit photos to the AstroPhys Facebook site? If not, they can submit it to the Southern Skywatch site and I can share it from there to AstroPhys for people who have managed to get some photos. Okay?
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Ian. Good night, mate.
Good night, and you have a great Easter, and hopefully you have time to look at the skies in between all family fun and catch-ups.
See ya.
See you, mate. Bye.
And remember, AstroPhys is free and unsponsored. But we always recommend that you check out Dr. Ian Musgrave's AstroBlogger website to find out what's up in the night sky. And in 2 weeks, we're bringing you a wonderful interview from the recent Transients Down Under conference in Melbourne, Australia, where we spoke with Professor Katie Ockertel, who is the Associate Professor of Astrophysics and Physics from Melbourne University. Her stellar research and science journeys are sensational. Katie is an observational astrophysicist whose research focuses on the extreme death of stars. You'll love this next episode and keep looking up.
Radio Wave!